Hi, thanks for joining us for this episode of Into the Killing. If you've listened to other episodes before, thanks for coming back and listening again. If this is your first episode, we hope you find it interesting. The case we're looking at today happened in 1985. On December 11th, 1985, 38-year-old Hugh Scrunn became the first person to be killed by the serial killer known as the Unabomber. 5 days later, Paul Castellano, the head of the Gambino crime family, and Thomas Pilotti, the family's underboss, were shot to death. John Gotti ordered the hit in a power grab. After the murders, Gotti became the new head of the Gambino family, which was the most powerful crime syndicate in America. The number one song was Say You, Say Me by Lionel Richie. For the entire month of December, the number one movie was Rocky IV. The fourth film in the Rocky series is the most financially successful in the franchise. For 24 years, it was the highest grossing sports movie. The Blind Side took over that title in 2009. In December 1985, 81-year-old Ed Murren and his 83-year-old wife, Wilhelmina Mary Murren, who went by the name Minnie, lived in Chehalis, Washington. Chehalis is primarily a logging and railroad town. In 1985, it had a population of around 6,000 people. The Murrens were well known in the area. They got married later in life when Ed was 57 and Minnie was 59. Minnie's first husband had died in the 1950s. She had four children with him. In 1985, Ed and Minnie had 14 grandchildren and 14 great-grandchildren. The couple lived modestly, but their house was on a huge lot. On their large plot of land, they grew and sold Christmas trees. Both were members of the Catholic Church, and they were friends with people in their congregation. On December 19, 1985, they were hosting a Christmas potluck at their home for other members of the church. When their guests arrived, the couple wasn't home, and their car wasn't there. It was unusual for them to make plans and then blow them off without telling anyone. Ultimately, the police were called. They got into the couple's home. They found signs of foul play in the house. There were bank statements strewn about on the floor. Minnie's purse, which she took with her everywhere, was in the house. At first, it was thought that the couple was kidnapped and they were being held for ransom. Minnie's son owned one of the biggest logging companies in the Northwest. So the family and the police were waiting for a ransom call. But then the next morning, their car was found abandoned in a parking lot at a local shopping center. The interior of the car was covered in blood. But Ed and Minnie were not in the car. Several hundred people were involved in the search for the Murrens. On Christmas Eve, 5 days after they were reported missing, a man was driving down a logging road about 11 miles west of Chehalis. He thought he saw a CPR dummy on the side of the road, so he stopped to get a closer look. It turned out he had found the dead body of 83-year-old Minnie Murren. Not far from her body was the body of 81-year-old Ed Murren. Both had been shot with a shotgun. Mary had been shot in the shoulder and the neck. Ed had been shot square in the back. The police noted that there were drag marks in the dirt. The police believed that the couple was killed in their car and that their bodies were dragged and dumped on the side of the road. The police tracked the last movements of the couple. On the morning that they were reported missing, Ed called one of the banks in town. He said he wanted to withdraw $8,500 in cash because he wanted to purchase a new car. He arrived at the bank just before 11 a.m. The cashier tried to convince him to take a check, but he refused. Instead, he took $8,500 in 100 bills. The police theorized that the kidnapper or kidnappers held Minnie in the car while Ed went into the bank. After getting the money, they forced Ed to drive to the logging road. Then they were both executed in the car and dragged to the side of the road. The killer or killers then dumped the car. The murder shocked the community. Ed and Minnie seemed like unlikely murder victims. Unfortunately, the police had very little evidence to go on. They didn't have any fingerprints or the murder weapon. The police thought that the killer or killers might have been local. That was because, by outward appearances, Ed and Minnie didn't appear to have a lot of money. Yet, they were the target of a robbery. So the police suspected that the killer or killers knew that the couple had money saved. The police thought that the killer might not just have been local, but he may have been a family member of Ed and Minnie. One reason they thought this, because there were no signs of a break-in or forced entry. So Ed and Minnie may have known their killer or killers and felt comfortable letting them into their home. One person they suspected was one of their grandsons, Mike Hadler. Mike had a few run-ins with the law. He had a temper, and things got worse when he drank. Mike was upset that he was considered a suspect, so he didn't cooperate with the investigators. On New Year's Eve 1985, 12 days after the murders, two women contacted the police. They said that they saw a man running away from Ed and Minnie's car in the parking lot where it was abandoned. They thought he was carrying a rifle that had been wrapped in something like a cloth. He ran out of the parking lot and into some trees. The women described the man to a sketch artist. They said he had dark hair and he had some beard growth. The sketch looked a lot like Mike Hadler. The police took photos of suspects that matched the description the women gave. Then they showed the two women a photo lineup. Neither of them picked out anyone from the lineup. So the case went cold. Four years later, in April 1990, the police received a tip. The caller said that a man named Scott Coulter, who had been married to one of Ed and Minnie's grandchildren, had apparently bragged about committing the murders. Coulter had a criminal record, and he had been involved in the sale of drugs. The police decided to set up a Mr. Big Sting on Coulter. Mr. Big Stings are highly controversial procedures used to elicit confessions. They are controversial because they lead to people falsely confessing. In this case, undercover officers pretended to be mafia members and they met with Coulter. They told him they would induct him into the gang if he told them a secret crime he had committed. They said they heard he had been involved in the murder of an elderly couple. To prove it, they wanted details about the murders. Coulter said he did commit the murders, but every detail he gave was incorrect. For example, he said he shot them with a .22 caliber handgun when they were really shot with a shotgun. It was clear to the investigators that Coulter knew nothing about the murders. In an interview with Cold Case Files, one of the detectives said that had Coulter read the newspaper accounts, he would have been more accurate. So he was eliminated as a suspect. The case became cold yet again. Mike Adler said he felt like many people thought he was guilty. He said it made him an angry person and he continued to drink and get into trouble. He said he wanted to find the person who killed them and torture them to death. 20 years after the murders, in November 2005, Mike was living in Vancouver, Washington. An old friend, Jake Shriver, approached him and told him he had something to tell him. He said he had been living with a guilt for years and it was killing him. Shriver explained that when he was 17, he was in the car and his mother was driving. Suddenly, the Murrens' car pulled out in front of them and it was moving slowly. So they passed them. In the front seats were the Murrens. In the back seat were two men. Shriver said they knew the two men. It was the said brothers, John and Rick Reif. Shriver knew them because he had worked on the Murrens tree farm with the brothers. Shriver said that John Reif came up to him 2 days later and asked him if he had told anyone. Shriver said he didn't say anything. John said if they didn't keep his mouth shut, they would wipe out his entire family. Then the brothers started driving by his family's home. Mike convinced Shriver to go to the police. Shriver did and told them what he saw. The police looked into the Reifs. They had criminal records and they were known drug addicts. Shortly after the murders, they moved to Alaska. After Shriver told him about the Reifs, Mike learned that the brothers were living in King Salmon, Alaska. Mike decided to move to King Salmon and track down the brothers. He wanted to kill them and feed their bodies to the crabs. But he couldn't find them. The detective showed photos of the Reif brothers to the witnesses. They identified them as the men they saw. In June 2012, they were able to get a warrant for their arrest. On the day they got the warrants, John Reif died from natural causes. Nevertheless, detectives flew to King Salmon and went to Rick Reif's house. 26 and a half years after Ed and Minnie Murren were killed, the police arrested Rick Reif. 55-year-old Rick Reif went to trial in October 2013. The trial lasted 6 weeks. Two people who testified against Reif were a married couple, Leslie and Deborah George. Leslie said he had been friends with the Reif brothers in the 1980s when they lived in Washington State. Leslie said that a week before the murder, he told the Reif brothers that the Murrens had a lot of money. He had also let Rick Reif borrow a shotgun in 1984, and he did not get it back until 1986. Years later, Rick sent a Facebook request to Leslie, who shared an account with Deborah. Deborah started talking to Rick about a year before he was arrested. Their online relationship turned sexual. Deborah said that she and Rick talked about the murders. Deborah knew things about the murders that were never made public. For example, she said that Rick told her he had struck Ed on the head before he shot him. The medical examiner testified that Ed had suffered a blunt force trauma wound on the head. That information had never been released to the public. The jury deliberated for a day and a half. Rick Reif was found guilty on all charges. He was sentenced to 102 years in prison. It's unclear where Rick Reif is serving his sentence because he is not listed on Washington's Department of Corrections website. If he is alive today, he would be 63 years old. Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. We hope you enjoyed it. Our producer, fact-checker, and sound designer was Anel Cloutier. This is our last episode of the year, but we hope you and your loved ones have a great holiday and a wonderful new year. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be returning with a new episode on January 16th. Also, in 2022, we'll be releasing new episodes every other week. If you just know about our podcast, you should check out our YouTube channels. The first is Criminally Listed, which has over 325 videos featuring bizarre but true crime stories. You can find it at youtube.com/criminallylisted. The other channel is Paranormally Listed. It's about hauntings, alien sightings, cryptid encounters, and the unexplained. You can find it at youtube.com/paranormallylisted. So once again, we want to wish you the best in the new year. Thanks again for listening. Please take care of yourself and stay safe.